Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. After a short recess, we are ready for the oral argument in the third of three cases today with oral arguments. The next case is number A20-939, In Re, Don and Beverly Gurish Replacement Housing Payment Claim. And if I've mispronounced relator's name, I trust that appellant's relator's counsel will correct my pronunciation. I assume both of you are familiar with our standard procedures. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Relator's counsel will then have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. If you you will be able to see the time clock at all times if you maintain the appropriate view, gallery view, or perhaps another view where it's at the top of the screen. It'll be there somewhere. So with that, counsel for Relator, you may identify yourself and begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. If it pleases the court, my name is John Morphew, and I'm appearing today on behalf of Relators Don and Beverly Gurish. Based upon the arguments of the city and the decision of the administrative law judge in this matter, acquiring authorities in relocation cases can now arbitrarily determine how much they were paid for just the residential portion of a property in cases like this, where it purchases a large piece of property for one gross purchase price based upon its commercial value. Such a conclusion is contrary to the Uniform Relocation Act, which requires that all displaced persons be treated consistently and equitably, especially when the Federal Highway Administration has established a standardized procedure for making such a determination in cases like this.
So, Mr. Morphy, you say arbitrarily, but wasn't there a pretty rational approach to doing it? I mean, your client had an opportunity to sell the home and only the home for $350, declined that offer. So to ask for the extra benefit later on, in order to purchase a home worth, I think, $325, assumes that the value of the home, how could the home be valued for less than $200,000 if your clients refused an offer to sell it for $350? If it's really worth less than $200, they should have snatched up that offer.
I'm not sure if I totally understand the question, but I mean, in this case, there's no evidence beyond the initial appraisal as to what the house was worth. The initial appraisal determined that the value of the necessary property was $236,700. And everything beyond that was based upon the commercial value. Had my clients rejected, or they did, had they accepted the $350, then this would be a moot point. There would be no case. But the reality is they sold they rejected that offer and sold the entire property for the $1.62 million based upon its commercial value.
But isn't that negotiating history evidence of the value of the necessary parcel, or which is basically roughly the home itself and surrounding land, right? But isn't that negotiating history evidence of the value of the home itself?
Well, but we don't know what that offer was based upon. Had they accepted that offer for just that portion and retained the balance of the property, then I think the city's argument might have some merit, but they didn't. And anything above that initial offer is based upon the commercial value of that property. We have no idea, based upon the facts that were stipulated to by the parties, we have no idea what that offer was based upon. There was no new appraisal. There was no new analysis. I mean, that's almost a 48% increase in the value of that house. Clearly,
okay,
that's not.
I need to sharpen my question. I feel like it's almost obvious. I mean, if we're trying to find out how much the home is worth, if your clients declined an offer to sell it for $350, then in your clients' minds, that property is worth more than $350. Isn't that an unavoidable inference? And then can't that fact be used to determine the allocation of the purchase price?
No, I don't think so, because that's not any indication necessarily what they thought the residence was worth. Their thinking is that the entire property is worth something, you know, the $1.62 million. That's what they're thinking. They're not thinking, you know, they clearly wanted, they didn't want to be left selling the residence, and then left with sort of this remainder property that was subjected to whatever road project that's going to be going on. They wanted to sell the entire property, and that was based upon its commercial value. So that's why I think the short answer to that question is no, we don't know. That I don't think that proves that. So,
Mr. Morphew, can I ask you a little bit about summary judgment, or in this case, I guess, summary disposition, both parties' mutual motions and our review? And you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it's my understanding we review the matter de novo, but we give deference to the agency as it applies to interpretation of statutes, I believe is the case law quoted language. Now, but in this case, we've got stipulated facts. There seems to be no dispute on any of the facts. You've kind of summarized some of them already. And the statutes themselves, actually, it's mostly CFR regulations, I think, that everyone's quoting, and you even referenced a highway administration a procedure. What I'm trying to understand is that, on the other hand, the court didn't identify any particular rule or statute that the parties disagreed with, but instead factually came to a conclusion then following the lines of Judge Johnson, that everything was 50% more than what the original offer was. Hence, there's no basis for additional payment here. What I'm trying to understand from our standpoint, maybe you can help me, Mr. Morphew, it strikes me that perhaps more facts needed to be developed. I guess what I'm getting at is it seems reasonable on one hand, the inferences perhaps that the respondent asked the court to consider, but objectively the only appraisal was less, as you point out. On the other hand, you point out that the analysis of a square footage, the Fishbach decision, would be an objective basis. Perhaps neither one would be unreasonable, but we're reviewing the facts as stipulated, and there's no expert testimony, as I understand it, as to this property and the rest of the lot versus the displaced house, none of that. Can you help me just a little bit how we're supposed to look at that and determine either? I guess my point I'm getting at is you're asking this court to reverse, I assume, period. And yet that would require us to say that there was a specific error in interpreting either a fact or the law. And yet my understanding, there's no law that requires the Fishbach analysis to be used. It's been used and the court did distinguish that, but yet there's no law to require the alternative. Why right. would not a remand perhaps for further facts and maybe expert evaluation as to best use of the property and a separate valuation of the displaced house like we have versus the rest of it as it relates to the 1.6. Now the court has facts to make a determination.
And I understand that, but I think that in this case, there really is no need for a remand because the facts have been stipulated to. There is a procedure underneath the Uniform Relocation Act for how you apply the facts of this case to the 49 CFR 24.403A7, which is we have to figure out based upon the purchase price actually paid for the entire property, what was paid for just the displacement dwelling part. And that's the error of law that the administrative law judge made. He said that the city was allowed to arbitrarily, make up its own procedure. I think the quote was, the regulations lack clarification as to how that amount should be calculated. Therefore, the city is required to formulate a method for doing so. That's wholly incorrect. The regulations are clear, and the guidance provided by the Federal Highway Administration clearly state that if a property is purchased at a value higher than residential, like commercial in this particular case, and in the commercial value in that exhibit, Relator's Exhibit 4 submitted to the administrative law judge states that you simply just take whatever that gross purchase price is, you divide it by the number of square feet to arrive at a per square foot value, then apply that to the size of the displacement dwelling. It's a pretty simple two or three step process. And in probably 95% or more of the cases, it's going to result in the displaced homeowner not receiving a replacement housing payment. But there are going to be certain cases like this one where the cost of a comparable replacement building is so high and the purchase price is relatively low for a commercial value property, there is going to be a replacement housing payment that's owed to the property owner. And the clients are not seeking a windfall. So that's why I think the error of law comes in, is that the facts are pretty simple. We know what they were. We know what the city paid. And then you just do the math and you do the simple calculation. That's where I think he erred, is that the ALJ concluded the city can just on a case-by-case basis decide how much they paid for a particular piece of property in cases like this, and that's the error.
Well, who had the burden of proof in proving up the claim for the replacement property payment?
Well, we were the ones who were seeking it. It was cross motions for summary judgment. If it matter goes to, if it had gone to an evidentiary hearing, the burden of proof is on the displaced homeowner. If it had gone to an evidentiary hearing, but it was cross motions for summary judgment in this case. So I presume both sides have the burden to prove or disprove their motion.
But how, I mean, I'm looking at this and I just want to make sure I understand what your argument is. Are you arguing that the court should have just taken the size of the dwelling itself without any land around it?
No, it was what was defined as, no, the displacement dwelling includes some additional property around it for what would consider to be a typical residential size lot. So okay, in this case,
you're not disputing the 0.74?
No, we're not disputing that. And in this case, the city concluded that it was 32,316 square feet was a typical residential lot. And we're not disputing that. So what we're saying is that based upon the $1.62 million that was paid for the entire property, if we divide that by the total number of square feet of the 6+ acres, that results in a payment of $5.96 per square feet paid for the entire property based upon its commercial value. And if we multiply that by the 32,316 square feet, which is the site of the lot of the displacement dwelling, that results in a total acquisition cost of $192,603 based upon the commercial value of that property. So,
Mr. Morphew, can I clarify your point about the square footage, the regulation? Number one, is it your understanding that's mandatory in all cases? And if so, does it say that in the rule or elsewhere? But secondly, my question is, if that was then an appraisal would not be needed, as I understand. But I understand here an appraisal will be one basis upon which we have an appraisal of the displaced property. We don't, and then we have an appraisal for the whole thing, essentially. You could have competing appraisals. That would not use the square footage. I assume the point being is there might be competing experts to come to a conclusion as to what the non-displaced portion of the property is worth as it relates to the total. And that would not relate to square footage. It might have to do with best use. I think that phrase was used a lot of the property. Am I correct? So that would be an alternative to simply a square footage analysis.
But that's not how the guidance from the Federal Highway Administration reads. It says that if a property is purchased based upon its commercial value, then you just simply do the math. You do the subdivide. You don't worry about appraisals and things like that. Like in Fishbach, the commissioners awarded, I don't remember the exact amount, but the total amount they offered for the two different parcels, and then that was divided out, and they concluded the per square foot value in Fishbach, and they just applied that to the dwelling size or the typical residential lot in that particular case, which resulted. And I believe she was paid about $8 or $9 a square foot for her property. So that resulted in no replacement housing payment. So I don't think there's necessarily any need for further remand to do any appraisals or analysis or expert opinions. I think it's just the parties have stipulated to that fact.
What is your disagreement with the court, which did, and I think factually, at least accurately, distinguish the Fishbach case? And there the displaced house had no value. Here it has at least 230 some, I think, based on the initial appraisal, if not more.
That would assume that this property was, the Fishbach property did have the home did have value. And we cite that in our brief where it talks about the initial offer that did have the initial offer for just the property identified. I believe that the value of the house was about $130,000 because there was about a $30,000 or $39,000 initial residential or replacement housing payment was offered initially in the Fishbach case. And that was a separate, remember, there were two separate taxable parcels, one with the house and then one with the farming land. Those were two separate pieces of property that were acquired together. So presumably in the before, the house had value, which is evidenced by the fact that a replacement housing payment was offered initially by the city in that particular case. But when the two parcels were combined and acquired as one, the residents had no value. In this case, we have one single taxable parcel that had all of the land. And so presumably the house had some value in that case. The house probably had some value in this case, but I'd argue in this case, it's actually one step closer because it was only one single parcel that was bought as a commercial piece. Whereas in that case, you had two separate, you had a residential parcel and a farm parcel that were combined into one. So presumably—
Can you just clarify, Mr. Morphy, on the law with regard to use of property, because in both cases, a condemnation is being threatened. So if you don't reach an agreement, I assume that means there'll be no residential use of that property.
In this case?
Right.
Correct. Yeah, there is no residential use of the property.
That not true in Fishbach as well, at least as it related to the necessary part of that
true
property?
That's true.
So when we talk about best use, does that mean best use if the city had hypothetically decided not to use it, but we're simply trying to evaluate this property? Or is it best use after the city has condemned the portion it's necessary and now you have a bare lot or maybe a house, if that's possible, but in our case, a bare lot left? In other words, is best use before condemnation or after? And what relevance does that play in either the agency's evaluation of it or ours?
I don't think it really plays anything into it in this particular case because of the fact that had the city bought the property, that bought the home as a displacement dwelling and just paid the $350 for it, we wouldn't be here. But it's the fact that they paid one commercial price, one price for the entire property. That's why I don't think that this is nearly as confusing or as difficult as the city wants to make it out to be or the ALJ makes it out to be. I think the law is clear. I think the guidance provided by the Federal Highway Administration is clear. In that case, the house was valued at $30,000, but it was bought at $10 per square foot. The house was valued at $30,000 in that guidance. It was purchased at a commercial value of $10 per square foot. So we just did the simple math in that hypothetical and it resulted in no housing replacement payment. But in this case, it does. So I think it's just very simple and straightforward.
I think you made a statement a minute ago about that after the condemnation, the property can only be commercial. Is that as a matter of zoning?
I don't know that I made that. I think it was purchased based upon its commercial value. I don't remember the zoning. I don't remember that issue.
Well, the ALJ relied on evidence that its best use was residential, or perhaps at least in part residential. And, but do you disagree with that?
Yeah. I mean, because if you look at the records replete with the evidence that it was in the before, if it was just a standalone house, then yes, that's true. But if the property is all acquired in total, then it would be put to a mixed use redevelopment scenario. So it bought, so that means in a total acquisition, the residence no longer has any value because you wouldn't buy 6 acres at the corner of 610 and 169 to keep an old dumpy farmhouse on it. You're going to put that to redevelopment. So theoretically, but what if it's just bought as a single standalone house, then maybe, but when it's the entire property is purchased, it's for a mixed use redevelopment purpose.
Are there any cases in your brief that are exactly like this one?
No, I mean, other than Fishbach, I mean, because they're very few of these types of cases get litigated. And this fact scenario is pretty rare. Because like I said, 95% of the time, it's going to result in no replacement housing payment. But this is one of the ones where it does. So unfortunately, there is, and believe me, I've searched. So,
you know, can I just ask you this? And I'm sorry, I turned off my video, but this is Judge Hooten, because I'm having broadband problems. But in looking at the addendum on page 7, when it talks about what constitutes a displacement dwelling and what is required for a comparable replacement housing, doesn't that necessarily require, in order to figure that out, that you compare an actual dwelling with another comparable dwelling? And so that you, because it seems like you're just saying, oh, well, what we're comparing is commercial property with a dwelling, whereas the whole essence of what's required for, a replacement housing payment is the comparison between two dwellings. So doesn't that kind of drive what you consider here?
And I understand where you're coming at, but I think the reason why it's not necessarily comparing, dwellings. Yes, we compare dwellings for the search for the comparable replacement dwelling, but if we just focus on what's paid for just the Gorsh's displacement dwelling, it might result in a windfall, because if we just simply said, look at the appraisal, it says the house was only worth $236,000, and it might result in a windfall. That's why you have to apply the per square foot commercial value. So you're looking at the per square foot commercial value of just the plot of land, not necessarily the dwelling itself, for determining what they were paid. That doesn't mean you don't compare the Gorish's actual house in terms of bedrooms, square footage, bathrooms, location, those sorts of things, when looking at a comparable replacement dwelling to find out what it would cost for them to purchase a new home. But in terms of establishing the basis, you look at what they're paid for just the square footage upon which that home sits at its commercial value.
Thank you, Mr. Morphew. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank
Council
you.
For respondent, you may identify yourself and begin.
Yes, good morning. May it please the court, Doug Shaftel on behalf of the City of Brooklyn Park. I am going to abandon my outline a little bit risky, I know, but I've heard a lot of questions that make me think that I should try to explain how the replacement differential housing payment works in the context of one that we have here, where we have a residential house that was sitting on a larger property, 6.24 acres, that included area that could be developed into some sort of higher use, such as commercial or mixed use, I think is what the appraisal concluded. And the reg that applies here is 49 CFR 24.403. And that regulation is specifically applies with regard to mixed use properties. And if the displacement dwelling, and I'm reading it here, if the displacement dwelling was part of a property that contained another dwelling unit or space used for non-residential purposes, and or is located on a lot larger than typical for residential purposes, only that portion of the acquisition payment which is actually attributable to the displacement dwelling shall be considered the acquisition cost when computing the replacement housing payment. In short, when you've got this type of property and there's only been a payment made, a single large payment made, the city does not get the benefit of saying we paid you $1.62 million for your property, and therefore, because that number exceeds $325,000, the amount you would need to buy a comparable replacement dwelling, you don't get a replacement differential housing payment. The city has to carve out, and it's undisputed that that's required, carve out the excess land from the residential dwelling. That's what the city did here. And the way it did it was it looked at the amount that it offered for the necessary property, not once, but twice. It started by offering approximately $250,000 for the necessary property. That amount was rejected. It increased its offer by almost 40%, a little bit more than 40%, to approximately $350,000. That offer was rejected. Then, because the appellants wanted the city to negotiate for the entire property, the city also offered, at the same time as it offered $350,000 for the necessary property, it offered $1.52 million approximately for the overall property. And then eventually—
Heftel, can I interrupt you? Because yeah. I'm confident we understand those numbers and I appreciate the summary.
Yeah.
But first, obviously, since the parties chose not to identify what portion of the price paid was for the displaced value, I first wanted to clarify, I assume that's why we're talking about valuation rather than price paid for the displacement, because there is no facts as to the price paid because the parties chose not to identify the price paid. So number one, that's why we're talking valuation versus price paid as the regulation requires. Am I correct?
I agree with you that we do not have an allocation in the purchase agreement that says this is how much the city paid. Yes. What the city, however, this is contemplated in the regs that there will be situations like this. What the regs
isn't that what leads into what Mr. Morphy is saying? The only guidance anywhere we would find where we don't have a price paid mm-hmm. would be the square foot. Why would not we look at that and simply say that the ALJ erred, because as a matter of law, the only guidance that we can see in any of these regulations is a square footage.
Well, in the FHWA guidance that he's referring to, as well as the Fishbach case, the underlying assumption is that the highest and best use, which is the term used in the appraisals, in other words, the highest use, the best use for which will demand the highest value for the entire property is commercial. So in that FHW guidance in the Fishbach case, it was understood, all parties agreed, the highest and best use of the whole property, including the residential portion, was to redevelop it. Contrary to what the appellants have told this court, the appraisal concludes that the value of the residential portion is for continued residential use. That appraisal, which is in document 11 in the record, and it's attached to the affidavit of Nick Volley, done by Valbridge Property Appraisers, repeats in several places that the highest and best use of this whole property is to split off the home site from the commercial undeveloped land area and use that home site as continued residential use.
But I'm trying to understand a distinction, because as Mr. Morphy points out, there was, just like here, a dollar amount offered for the Fishbach house. I guess what I'm trying to get at is, as I understand the record, the only objective facts that we have in terms of getting to the ultimate purchase price is a $236,000 appraisal on one hand. We have arguably this methodology used, you're suggesting perhaps would not apply or should not apply. The methodology used by the city leads to an inference, if I understand correctly. So we have an appraisal and an inference. Is not the ultimate big question, and this is why I led to my question about maybe the advisability of a summary judgment, is what is the value of the 0.74 versus the rest of it? And you'd have a battle of the experts, at least from my district court experience, that's typically what we'd have. A court would then make findings since the parties chose not to differentiate that. Why would that not be an appropriate disposition for this court upon review?
Because we have an appraisal.
Well, that's my question, though. The appraisal would lead to a payment, though, to Mr. Morphy, because the appraisal is $236,000.
It did, Judge Slider. It resulted in a payment. The appraisal was the basis for the initial offer of $250,000. The parties negotiated. The city offered $350,000. The appellant said, no, we want you to acquire the whole property. The appraisal was the basis for the initial offer, for even the initial offer on the whole property of $1.5 million. It was just 40% more than the appraised value. The appraisal exists. It is based on a highest and best use that the residential portion has a separate value based on continued residential use. The city made in writing an offer to buy the necessary property for $350,000. Mr. Morf, you concede that if the Gorshes had accepted that offer, then we wouldn't be here. So this court can conclude based on that offer, that is the evidence, that is the scintilla of evidence needed on a substantial evidence standard of review, which is what this court is reviewing.
Here's my question though, when reviewing genuine issues of material fact, on one hand you have an appraisal and on the other hand, perhaps a reasonable inference as to what the real value is based on negotiating, but wouldn't that require actual fact finding for a court to make an ultimate conclusion? And then we would review that.
And I guess what I'm saying, Judge Slider, is ALJ Mortensen did that fact finding. He looked at the appraisal, he looked at the negotiations, he looked at the offers made, he made a factual finding that the city paid at least $350,000 for the necessary property. And the question for this court on review, this is a Minnesota Administrative Procedure Act appeal. And the question on this court on review is whether there is substantial evidence in the record to support that factual finding. The substantial evidence in the record is the existence of a written offer made by the city to purchase the necessary property of $350,000 and a rejection of that offer in negotiation for a higher value relative to the overall subject property. And so, yes, there is an inference, but there's more than enough facts in the record for ALJ Mortensen to conclude, as a matter of fact, that the city paid at least $349,998 for the necessary property.
Can I just follow up a bit, Mr. Shaftel? Would you agree that negotiating itself, there's many factors other than a value of property? In fact, I think it was your client here that part of its motivation, of course, in negotiating to avoid condemnation is the goodwill with the community. I guess my question is, given that, negotiating might be an inference, but again, it may not be the end result because there's a lot of other factors in terms of what the price actually is paid for the displaced property. Is that a reasonable proposition?
I would contend, Judge Slider, that the only facts this court has before it are an offer made by the city that was based on an appraisal to pay at least 40% more than the necessary property was appraised at. And so from that, the facts are that the city paid at least $349,998 for the necessary property. There is nothing in this record that suggests that either party was negotiating based on a dollar per square foot value for commercial property. And I need to reiterate that the appraisal does not support any conclusion that the residential portion of the property was valued based on a dollar per square foot value. It was always based on the conclusion that the residential portion has value independent of the commercial redevelopment potential of the remainder for continued residential use. So appellants are essentially asking for this court to let them have their cake and eat it too. They want two good things to happen simultaneously that cannot. They want to eat their cake by getting a 50% greater amount than they were initially offered for their necessary property and thus having more than enough money to buy a comparable replacement property. They want to have their cake in the form of a replacement differential housing payment. And indeed, they asked this court to give them a greater cake than they had in the first place if they had just accepted the original offer in the form of $132,000 replacement differential housing payment. If this court were to accept the position of the appellants, it would lead to absurd results that are contrary to the policy of the replacement differential housing payment. The purpose of the replacement differential housing payment is to make sure that owners are given enough money so that they can buy a comparable replacement dwelling, one that is safe decent, safe, and sanitary, and that has roughly the same attributes as the property that was purchased. If the owners had accepted the city's initial offer of approximately $250,000, they would have been eligible for a $75,000 differential housing payment. If they had accepted the $350,000 approximately offer for the necessary property, they would not have. Neither of those points are in dispute. And yet they argue that because they were paid 50% more for their overall property, that they should be entitled to an RDHP that is 76% greater than they would have been entitled if they had accepted the initial offer. That absurd result is exactly the opposite of what Congress intended when it created the RDHP. I guess I would just conclude by encouraging the court, if they have any questions about the highest and best use of the property, to review the appraisal that's in document 11. The appraisal makes very apparent that the property, the initial basis of these negotiations arose from the conclusion that the highest and best use of the residential area is for continued residential use. This court is reviewing on a substantial evidence standard the ALJ's conclusion that the city paid at least $349,998. That conclusion is supported by the negotiations, supported by the appraisal. It's supported by the fact that the city made a written offer of $349,998 for the necessary property, which was rejected. This court has more than enough evidence to affirm the ALJ's decision, and the city's respectfully request that it do so. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Shaftel. Mr. Morphy, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. One thing I want to clarify from Mr. Shaftel's argument is that second offer, and I'm not sure this is exactly what he said, but it made it sound like that second offer was based upon the appraisal. It was, in fact, not based upon the appraisal. In the stipulated facts, if you look at it, it says that that second offer was, quote, being made to try to avoid the need to acquire the property interest by condemnation, end quote. And in the stipulated facts, it says the city went on further to inform claimants that it believed its appraisal values are correct, and if that second offer was not accepted, it reserved the right to present valuation evidence consistent with the appraisal to a commissioner panel or jury as needed. So clearly, if anything, the only thing that just proves that the only thing that we know is that the city threatened condemnation if the clients, if the Gorishes didn't accept that second offer. And that if they didn't, they were going to go back to the appraisal to determine the amount of the property. So that would go back to the $236,700. So if anything, and I'm not abandoning our argument, but I'm just saying if we're going to stand upon that appraisal, as we know the only objective fact that we know of what that offer was based upon was the value of that house, was the value of the displacement dwelling, it would result in a replacement housing payment of at least $88,300. Because that's the only objective fact. There's two objective facts we can figure. One is we know what the appraisal said and what that initial offer was. And we know if we do the calculation as advocated by the Federal Highway Administration, what that results in. That stipulated fact shows that it was only being done as a basis of negotiation to avoid condemnation of the property. It wasn't based upon anything other than just negotiations and the commercial value of that property. So I think that I just wanted to make sure that that point got clarified, that the city stood by the fact that its initial appraisal of that property was correct. Another argument in both Mr. Shaftel and the ALJ seem to think that the Gorishes are asking for some sort of windfall in this matter. And I think we cited in our brief the passages from the ALJ's decision where he talks about this being a windfall. But if you look at even the argument that the city made in the Fishbot case in its brief, it says that a displaced homeowner in cases like this should not have to use funds that were paid for the balance of the property to purchase a new home. And that's exactly what they're asking the Gorishes to do in this case. They're saying, well, you got paid $1.6 million. That's a lot of money. That's more than enough money to go buy whatever house you want. But that's just not how it's supposed to work in these types of cases. If that's, let's say you got a significant mortgage on the property, or it's an investment property, those sorts of things. So you have to, essentially what they're asking them to do is sort of rob Peter to pay Paul. Take money you're being paid for the commercial value of that property, and now use that to go out and buy yourself a new home, because you've gotten a lot of money. So let's just all be reasonable about this. But that's just not how the law works. You're supposed to apply these things uniformly and equitably, so we're comparing apples to apples. And so people aren't forced to take money from one pot and put it towards another. What if they wanted to use the balance of that commercial proceeds to invest in another commercial property? So then they don't get what they had before. They're having to settle for something less than what they had before, either on the residential side or on the commercial side. And that's exactly what the city said displaced homeowners shouldn't have to do in the Fishbach case. But that's exactly what they're asking the Gorishes to do in this case. And that's wholly unfair.
Mr. Morphy, could you address the point Mr. Schaftel did, that the regulation you referenced from the Federal Highway Administration was properly not applied, and we should not consider it as well because of the best use evaluation by the initial appraiser?
I think that's completely wholly contrary to what that guidance says. Because when you look at that guidance, it talks about it being purchased at some higher value. It does talk about highest and best use, but it also talks about properties that are just purchased at a higher value than as residential. And I think that's the exact verbiage, was higher, at a higher value than its use as residential property. Clearly, this property was purchased for something much higher than its use as residential property. So in those particular cases, you apply the math and you just do the calculations, and it results in a replacement housing payment. So I think in this case, at a minimum, they're entitled to the difference between the appraised value of the house, of their displacement dwelling, to serve as a basis for their replacement housing payment. Or if you apply the Federal Highway Administration regulations, it results in them being entitled to that replacement housing payment that we're advocating for in our brief. And that's what the Gorishes are asking for, is a replacement housing payment in the amount of $132,397 based upon the guidance provided by the Federal Highway Administration and the arguments made by the city, frankly, in the Fishbach case.
Does the record reveal when your clients purchased the property?
When they purchased this particular property?
Yeah, when? How long have they owned it?
I don't think it does. I don't think the stipulated facts reflect that. I mean, it might be maybe in the city. It's probably in the city's appraisal.
Is there a stipulation or a finding as to their purpose in owning the property? I mean, your argument is sort of based on the assumption that it was their desire to sell the whole property, not to split it up. And I'm not sure whether, that's, perhaps that's an important part of this calculus. But I'm wondering if there's any fact, either a stipulated fact or a finding by the ALJ, as to what your client's purpose is, or whether your client's purpose should be used as sort of a premise for the calculation.
I don't believe that there was any sort of finding in that particular regard. Not that I recall, and I don't remember. That's not in the stipulated facts. I know they had lived there for a number of years. I don't remember exactly how many.
I mean, but for the condemnation, they would own a property of 6+ acres, and the portion with the dwelling is more valuable on a per acre basis than the remainder, correct?
I'm sorry, I guess I didn't quite understand.
They owned a lot of 6 acres, more or less. Mm-hmm. A small part of it had the dwelling. That part of it, the dwelling and the area around the dwelling, was worth more per acre than the remainder of the lot, right?
No, because it was valued. I mean, the house was only 200. The house was only worth $215,000. In the appraisal, and the appraisal for the entire property was over $1 million in the city's initial appraisal.
Right, but if we do the math about I mean, if it's and so if we take what was it, 0.7 acres for the
correct
dwelling? Yeah. So $236,000 divided by 0.7 is I think a greater value per acre than the remaining.
Right, but if some of that's going to be attributable to the improvement, it's not necessarily for the underlying land. I mean, the structure, and I don't remember what the Hennepin
that's
County
what we're talking about is the home, right? So if we're trying to replace the value of the home,
well, the cost to replace the home would have been $325,000 because that's what it would have cost them to buy a comparable replacement dwelling. But yeah, I suppose theoretically that's your argument's correct. But like I said, I think that's not, the rest of it is just valued as land. There are no other improvements on the property. So presumably if there were improvements on the remainder of the property, that would have been more valuable as well. So it's not totally an apples to apples comparison, I don't think. Because the Hennepin County, I don't remember what it was, and it's not in the record, but there was some value attributable to the improvements separate from the land, the underlying land.
Okay. No further questions. Judge Hooten, go ahead.
Can I ask one question? Yep. Yes. You know, I'm just looking at the administrative law judge's order and on addendum 10, where he distinguishes the Fishbach case. One thing he notes is that the appraiser indicated that the best before acquisition use of the necessary property was to continue the existing residential dwelling use.
Was that the question or?
Well, my question is, at what point, I mean, is it before acquisition that the assessment is made or after acquisition?
It's based upon what was paid for the entire property. In cases like this, it's based upon what's paid for the entire property, not necessarily what the appraised value is. It's what did the city pay for the entire 6 acres divided by the total square footage to arrive at a per square foot price paid. And then you multiply that by the size of the typical residential lot, which in this case was determined to be about 0.74 acres or 32,396 square feet, I believe. So it's not necessarily based upon the appraisal or anything like that. It's based upon what was actually paid when the payment's based on a higher use or a higher value, such as commercial for a residential type property.
And would you agree that if in fact that amount had been paid with the understanding that part of it was for the dwelling and with the appraised amount, that we wouldn't be here?
I'm sorry. I think
is it simple because there was one offer made and they indicated that they apportioned $350,000 to the dwelling. If the second greater offer had done the same thing, we wouldn't be here. Am I correct?
If they had if the city had just bought the residential portion of the property at $350,000, we wouldn't be here. That is true.
They didn't do that. Big offer.
I'm sorry, I lost you there for a second.
The 1.6 million or the amount that was ultimately paid. Because they did increase their offer for the whole property.
Correct.
And if that same apportionment had been made, we wouldn't be here. Am I correct?
Had there been some sort of allocation between the residential portion and the balance of the property that the parties had agreed to, then theoretically we wouldn't be here. But that, once again, that wasn't done. And like I said in my rebuttal, remember, the city threatened condemnation if the Gorishes didn't accept that second offer. They threatened condemnation and said, if we do go to condemnation, we're going to go back to the initial offer of $236,700 because we believe our appraisal values are correct, and that's what you're actually being that's what you're actually entitled to for just the residential portion of the property.
Okay, thank you.
It appears there are no further questions. Thank you to council for helping us understand a topic that's not easy to understand.
And that's true, Your Honor.
We will take the case under submission, under advisement, and the court will issue its opinion within 90 days.